Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Linda and I am a compulsive eater and your chairperson today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose to extend the hearts and hand of OA, of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution of our common problem. Whatever problem you have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today, we are delighted to have Don C. and Kimberly C. from the United States joining us to share their experience, strength, and hope, focusing on Together on the Road of Happy Destiny. I would like to welcome Don C. to the group and share his experience on practicing these principles in all his affairs.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Don, compulsive eater and food addict. The flyer says, a couple in OA sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Sounds like fun. We'll see what we can do here today. So my name is Don. I'm a compulsive eater and food addict. I've been in OA for 40 years. Abstinent for 38 years, maintaining for about three decades, 180 to 190 pound weight loss below my highest weight. I think that's about 85 or so kilograms in your metric. Thank you, Violet, for your invitation to Melbourne. Unfortunately, you know, the subject of this workshop forced me to stop and do a very thorough personal inventory. No, not my inventory, Kimberly's inventory. That's what I thought I should do, is Kimberly's inventory. Well, not really. That's supposed to be a joke, right? An old sponsor 40 years ago warned me in the fifth step, Dawn, this is your inventory, not your mother's and not your wife's. Let's look at your side of the street, not theirs. So that's what I'll be doing tonight. By the way, that's one of my most important points here today, probably, is don't take her inventory. Don't take his inventory. I didn't take Kimberly's inventory. Hopefully she didn't take mine, but we'll see. I have no idea what she's going to say, and she really doesn't know what I'm going to say except for a couple of charts. I came into the program 40 years ago, grossly obese, suicidal, and an atheist. Other than that, I had everything going for me, except for the weight. Most people in the regular world probably thought I was pretty functional because I was a great actor. I was an actor on stage my whole life. So pretense was my thing. I had an education, I had a good job in a great company, I had a nice home. But on the inside, I had reached the point of seeing no reason for continuing to live. I was stuck in a bad marriage. I was stuck in a job that was totally unfulfilling. And I saw no way out. I saw no possibility of any future for me. I couldn't stop eating. I really could find no purpose other than just making a paycheck, getting a paycheck to pay the bills. I didn't know how to live. I didn't know what to believe. I didn't know how to think. I didn't know how to look at the world, nor how to deal with people in a way that would bring peace to my soul rather than discomfort and fear. My insides and my outsides were totally out of alignment. I was stuck. I seemed to have missed that course someplace along the line in childhood about how to live life. I really just didn't know. All I learned in my childhood, in my young life, was how to stay in conflict with the world or separate from the world. It was always them versus us or them versus me. Don't trust anyone, my mother used to say. Everyone is out to get us. Everyone is out to take advantage of us in any way that they can. People are basically bad, not good. From my father, I got, you know, Don, real men are self-sufficient. Never, ever ask for help. No, you don't show emotions and you don't ask for help. If somebody helps you, then you're in debt to them and you don't want to be in debt to anybody. That's the kind of logic that I heard in my childhood. So I escaped from home at 17. I did a year of college, then dropped out and joined the military, U.S. Army, for 3 years, where I was fortunate to find my way into a research laboratory that was closely aligned with the university. And I started back to college while I was in the military, with them paying the bill, believe it or not. I finished college after deciding to leave the military. They did offer me money to stay, since they had paid part of my education, but I said no. I worked for a couple of years and then went back to graduate school. I was recruited off the university campus and ended up in a major American corporation that had offices all around the world. So on paper, my life looked great. There was this shy, scared kid from a backwoods coal mining community in the Appalachian Mountains, makes good with one of the most successful corporations in the world. But that was the facade. That was my outside, not my inside. I had taken the route leading to money rather than what I really wanted to do in my life. I wanted to go on for my PhD. I wanted to become perhaps a college professor or certainly a clinical psychologist helping people. I ended up retiring from that corporation in 1997 after 30 years. But I made it through those 30 only because halfway through that journey, I found OA. My 20s and 30s in the corporation, I was compulsively overworking and compulsively eating. Overworking was the same as my compulsive overeating. It was still driven by the fear, doubts, and insecurity inside of me. You know, I was so fearful that I wouldn't be good enough or I would get questions I couldn't answer or whatever. I overdid and overworked everything. That's what perfectionism is all about. My weight went up and down, and the up was always, the last up was always higher than the previous up. So I came close to suicide twice in the last year before I came to OA, but I didn't have the courage to go through with it, bottom line. Shortly after the second time, I heard of what I thought was a weight loss program. It was something I saw someplace that said thin for life. And so my messed up suicidal mind said, well, maybe if I lose some weight, maybe I'll feel a little bit better, or who knows, maybe I'll get the courage to go ahead and check out of life. I actually thought that. Other than that, I was totally sane. The program turned out to be OA. What dirty trick. It taught me a new way of eating and a new way of looking at and dealing with life. And then I began to learn what life and human relationships were all about. The ideas coming out in my childhood and that closed culture were totally counterproductive, self-destructive, dysfunctional. The underlying theme of my share here today is all about how I learned in OA to live, how I learned how to be a partner, how I learned how to be a friend, how I learned to take down the wall of pretense and protection that surrounded me and let someone into me. Intimacy, they say, into me see. That's what I'm talking about when I say intimacy. I allowed someone to come in. I became vulnerable at 41 years old for the first time in my life. I was no longer a stone. I felt again. Or maybe it was just that I allowed myself to feel again. Don't know, but I was able to love and to be loved and to love. So OA laid out a whole new paradigm for living that gradually gave me enough hope to continue living. The suicide didn't go away for a while. It was several months, but sometime in the first year, I began to have the hope that maybe, just maybe, I would have the courage to change my life. Just maybe, I said, if I did what these crazy people suggested that I do, I might still have a chance. So I was 41. Potentially a lot of years left if I chose to have some. So I dove in. I admitted myself to the metaphorical OA hospital and said, okay, Richard and Charlie, these were the hard-ass two guys that were beating me on the head. I said, okay, I give up. I'm here. What do? They put a big book and an AA 12 and 12 in my hand, and they said, start reading. The directions are in there, they said. And I, right there on my desk is that big book that I was handed. It's been recovered a couple of times and rebound, but it's still there. I can't throw it away because of all the notes in the margins, right? And I know lots of you know what that's about. So surrender to me wasn't giving up. Surrender to me was deciding to cooperate with a whole new set of life rules called the steps, traditions, and at that time, seven tools. That's what I surrendered to. It was rather ironic that 18 years earlier, I had in fact done my senior year in college thesis on AA and the big book. I had totally forgotten about this. 18 years later, and I walk in someplace and they hand me a big book. My thought, first thought was, are you kidding me? I think I said something dirtier than kidding. I said, this is all about drunks. And they just smiled at me and said, start reading. So, you know, what drove me to select that subject in the first place, back in my 18 years earlier to finish up my degree in psychology and anthropology, was a grandfather who was a gutter level drunk and child abuser. This was my mother's father. I had never met him in my entire life. My mother and her seven siblings had been abused by this guy. I had been kept totally away from him as I was growing up. From time to time, we visited my grandmother, but only when he was not there. I can remember a couple of times when we had to rush out because we were told he was leaving the bar up the street and he was on his way home and we had to get out of there or we were in trouble. So in OA, I began learning a whole new way of living. I was given a second chance at life, as I said. I do a gratitude list every morning as part of my daily treatment plan, I call it, or daily disciplines, 11-step stuff in the morning. And one thing that's almost always on that gratitude list after all these 40 years is the two words, second chance. I got a second chance at life. I came within an inch of death and got a second chance. So thank you, OA, for that second chance. The program for me was the personality transformation talked about in the appendix 2 of the big book. It was that transformation into a new person that showed me what love and service and all the manifestations of those words were all about. It was that transformation and all the learned new ways of looking at life and dealing it with life, be it attitudes or values or behaviors, that eventually led me into the relationship of my life with the woman sitting in the other end of this house at her computer right now that you see on the screen there. That's what we're here to talk about, this and what that's about. So let me give you some examples of my work on steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 as I began rebuilding myself into the person that I think God intended me to be. You'll hear in all these things the beginnings of learning to practice these principles in all my affairs, because that's underneath of everything I'm talking about here. Practicing these principles in all my affairs, starting with my spouse. I began to face and deal with life. I'll give you 5 or 6 instances here. I began to face and deal with life rather than whine and eat, as I say. I began taking responsibility. Charlie, that first tough love sponsor, said, time to grow up, Don. Time to take responsibility for yourself. You're old enough now. It's time to quit blaming your spouse, your wife, your education, your lack of education, your culture, your fill in the blanks. It's on you. You got choices, Don. You are a free human being. You have choices. And he was a guy that I always wanted to punch. Never did punch, but I always wanted to punch him because he was so tough. Another thing, I began to gradually let go of the self-centeredness and controlling. I stopped what I call my mental master planning for the world. I was imposing shoulds and oughts on people in my head and in all situations. Right? This is the way this should go. This is the way he should do. This is the way the president should do. This is whoever, whatever, right? The problem is nobody ever followed my directions because they couldn't read my brain to start with. and they couldn't know what they were supposed to do. So what that meant, I was always frustrated because people weren't doing it the way I thought it should be done. My way, my way, my way. Another one, I began to let go of the perfectionism that I mentioned before that ensured that I would always feel not good enough. You know, perfectionism is just one of the so-called stepchildren of fear. Controlling, perfectionism, procrastination, all those are outgrowths of fear. And that's where I was, so always felt not good enough. I began to let go of selfishness. There was a very gradual paradigm shift from how do I get, to how can I be useful? How can I be useful to my spouse? How can I be useful to my children, to my grandchildren, to the world at large? And eventually it became to the still suffering compulsive overeater. How can I work with others as partners to accomplish what needs to be done? You know, that 11-step prayer I say every day admonishes me to seek to comfort, understand, and love rather than to be comforted, be understood, and be loved. I begin practicing acceptance of the world as it is and letting go of the anger and resentment that I had against everything. I began to practice courage rather than fear. For a long time, it was simply white-knuckle courage. Charlie used to say, I don't give a damn if you're afraid doing it anyway. Do it anyway, you know? Courage is not the absence of fear. It's doing it anyway. And you know what happens when you do things you're afraid to do? Well, then you're not afraid to do them the next time. So, you know, there's some kind of name for that, exposure therapy or something like that. And that's what I really, what I did to combat the fear. I began to be authentic rather than that phony that I talked about, always pretending and always seeking strokes. So this was the beginning of learning how to be a loving and caring human being. But I had to get my own stuff together first. Sometimes we say this is a selfish program, but it's a different kind of selfish than we normally mean. It means that if I'm a prisoner of this disease with all its physical and emotional and spiritual ramifications, then I'm not really very useful to others or myself because I hate myself. Being unhappy with myself ensures troubled relationships, whether with spouse, kids, relatives, boss, neighbors. Self-acceptance of my humanness leads to the acceptance of the humanness of others. Self-forgiveness leads to the forgiveness of others. Self-respect leads to the respect of others. Self-love opens me to give love. The disease also sapped, and I see how it sapped my energy, reduced my capacity, dulled my intellectual ability. So my point here is I must take care of my disease first. It's not selfish to fix me, because in the fixing of me, I become able to be a full human being for another human being. A channel of God, some might say, a channel for God. The basic measure of that freedom is abstinence, freedom from the bondage of the disease. Abstinence becomes the gate through which I pass to being useful to others. Abstinence must be the most important thing in my life, and it is. 40 years. It's still the most important thing in my life, no matter what, no matter what. I must do whatever I need to do to get abstinent and to hold on to it. And for me, that power to do that comes from the living the steps, traditions, and tools. So I do a rigorous and lengthy 11-step process every morning that involves an opening prayer, planning my food activities, and even attitude for the day. I work on attitude these days. I read my daily books. I write on their applicability to me. I write a gratitude list, as I've mentioned. I do the usual serenity, third, seventh, and 11-step prayers, plus my own prayers. And then I usually end with affirmations. In front of me, I have a multi-page worksheet with all sorts of options on it, right? Things that I can do that I need to do or might want to do in the morning. There's prayers on there. There's affirmations on there. There's reminders on there. For example, a reminder that says, don't forget that God doesn't fix things. God gives me the power to take the actions that fix things. Or another reminder, don't forget that if I want something I've never had, I must do something I've never done. Or don't forget that life doesn't just happen to me. I co-create my life with God. I've been given the ability to make decisions and take actions that shape my existence. On the front of that 11th step worksheet is a long list of traits and values and attitudes and behaviors that I believe are the essence of the higher power of my understanding, this force for good deep within me. This list represents God's will for me in all things, beginning, of course, with my spouse. These are my objectives for living. I summarize my personal list of 56 traits, believe it or not, with Dr. Bob's words. Dr. Bob summed it all up in his one of his last talks when he talked about love and service being the objects of life. And that's what I summarized this long list of 56 things in. This list, these things on here, which include all of our principles of our steps, traditions, concepts, plus a bunch of others, this has been the purpose of my life for a lot of years. As part of my morning daily disciplines, I do a brief inventory. The brief inventory I do every day is, how was it living with me yesterday? How was it living with me yesterday? And in the old days when I was working, I would say, how was it working with me yesterday? And how was it living with me yesterday? I do a lengthier one against my long list every couple of weeks. And of course, you know, Big Book talks about an ongoing inventory. So that's 24/7 ongoing, looking for selfish dishonesty, resentment, fear. And I always add false pride to that. Affirmations. I mentioned affirmations are very important for me. I learned a long time ago that I can change how I feel by changing the sentences going through my head. In the same way that I can change myself by practicing living in the solutions rather than simply trying to avoid problems or simply asking God to remove the defect. So give you four or five examples of my affirmations. I am abstinent no matter what. I know God is always with me. I am loving and helpful to others, beginning with my spouse. I accept the reality of my age and physical condition. I surrender to the uncontrollable flow and cycles of life. I have faith that God will give me the strength to deal with whatever comes. I hold on to hope that the physical pain and disability will not worsen. That's a whole nother story of my last few years with the pain and disability. So that's some examples of the affirmations that I do. I do some sort of these every day. So I was exactly 5 years into my recovery, working on transformation, working on all this personality change, and doing pretty well at it, actually. 5 years into my recovery, very different person, and I was traveling on business in Europe when I ran into a woman in front of the literature table at an OA English-speaking meeting in Paris, France. Quite a few years younger, but some feeling that I had never felt before, as far as I knew, surged through my body and my brain. Crazy. My mouth was talking about the literature on the table and what literature they had and so forth at this Paris meeting, but my brain was swirling and trying to figure out what the hell's going on here. What is this? What is going running through me? She was an American. She was from California. She was living and working in Paris for several years, and she had found OA in Paris. She was walking on the same OA path I was walking on. She just had a little less time. The rest is history. 36 years later, we're still walking the path together, in gratitude to whatever brought us together. I don't know what it was. Was it coincidence? Was it happenstance? Was it serendipity? Was it fate, fluke, accident, God, or maybe just OA? Don't know. All I know for sure that she's always first on my gratitude list every day. Every day, I put KDC, her initials, first on the list. All right, 5 minutes to go. So I want to show you, I talked about this long list of traits and so forth. Let me show you three charts quickly in the 5 minutes we have left. These are charts that I use in my workshops. I do step study workshops, and I use these. This one, this particular first chart I use in steps eight and nine, where we're looking for, have I done harms? What you've got to hear here is a list of harms, damage to others, that I have pulled out of big book, both 12 and 12s, other 12 sources, other 12-step sources. And these are the kinds of things that I look at. These are obviously the opposites of what I want to be. But these are always helpful to people to run down through these to take a look at your own life. And of course, everything I'm talking about here today is you taking a look at yourself and your relationships. The big ones I put X's by: anger, blaming, compulsive eating itself, controlling, criticism, cruelty, dishonesty, disloyalty, dominating, gloominess, impatience, inconsiderate, indifferent, intolerant, irresponsible, irritable, jealous, lazy, lying, neglect, not doing my share, perfectionism, of course, self-centeredness, temper, unfaithfulness. Okay, the second chart, Kimberly, if you'd run that up. This is a mountain of words, but it spells out specifically what I'm talking about when I think, practice these principles in all my affairs. This is the words that I'm thinking about. The two left columns are Don's list of 56 ways that I call God's will for Don. You see a long list there. Those are Don. In the right two columns, you'll see the more or less formal words that go with the concepts and the traditions and the steps. All of those concepts over there, all of those ideas or principles for living in those two columns are within, I believe, my left two columns. So you see some key things in here. Abstinence, as I mentioned before, number one thing. Being accountable, authentic, calm, compassionate, constructive, courteous, empathy, equality, flexible, forgiving, compromising, not judging, on the bottom there, that about left column. Honesty, kindness. Kindness is probably the number one thing that I would always, that I will end this whole thing with, kindness. Open-mindedness, patience, politeness, self-respect, etc. A long list. This is what I inventory against. This is the boy I want to be. This is the grown-up that I want to be. This is the man that I want to be. I believe when I do this, this is God's will for me as I understand my higher power. Now let's simplify this a little bit and go to the third chart, Kimberly. On the third chart, I reduce this inventory down to everyday essentials for me. This is the one I use in steps 6 and 7 all the time. People say, well, 6 and 7, what is that? What are they all about? And I say they're all about learning to live in the left column as opposed to the right column. I'm asking God to help me live in acceptance and tolerance rather than criticism, judging, and animosity. Help me, asking God to help me live in forgiveness rather than hate and resentment. So what I've learned in my experience is that I act my way into right thinking, not think my way into right acting. So my purpose is to learn to live in that left column. Be accepting, take responsibility, be grateful, be faith, have faith, trust others, humility, love, tolerance, compassion, calmness, proactivity, etc. These are Don's words. This isn't off of any AA or OA chart or anything. These are just Don's 40 years of experience in what I do today. So thank you, Kimberly, for screen sharing those. Let me just finish up by saying a few things that I noted in my journal. I did do a little inventory last week, but my own, not Kimberly's. And I said, okay, what is the biggest things that I think make us really go, that keep us alive and going forward? And I made a little list here, and it says, we are kind to each other no matter what. We are polite to each other no matter what. We are respectful of each other no matter what. We cooperate in all our tasks. We are partners in everything. We are a team. Clearly, we are a team. We share responsibilities for everything. But we are also each responsible for our own recovery. yes, we're on the same OA road, but we have our own lanes. She had for different, she eats different things, for example, than I do. She has to be responsible for her own recovery. But we support each other's program. We are grateful to have each other. And every night we say, I love you. So just a few things that came to mind last week as I was looking at. So let me just close by giving you a quote that I came across years and years and years ago that I feel really describes this relationship. And that's a quote from the French philosopher Albert Camus. I'm not sure about the pronunciation, but some of you know him. He says, don't walk behind me, I may not lead. Don't walk in front of me, I may not follow. Just walk beside me and be my friend. And that's the relationship that I believe that I have attained thanks to OA. I've learned everything from OA. OA gave me a life. What a hell of a life it's been. Thank you guys for asking us to come.
Thank you very much, Don. Just a reminder to continue sending your questions for our speakers using the chat, selecting moderator Mickey. I would now like to welcome Kimberly C. to the group to share her experience on the Big Book and relationships. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you so much, Linda, and thank you everybody for inviting us to be here this evening, this morning, this afternoon. I'm on a WSBC committee with somebody in Melbourne, and it always blows my mind that she's in tomorrow when we meet. So thank you, Don. I didn't know what you were going to say. You didn't embarrass me too much. Such a tease. So I'm going to just spend a little bit of time telling you about what I was like before OA, and then I'll jump into the subject. So what I was like before OA is I was someplace between fat and obese for 27, 28 years, my whole life before OA. I hated being fat. And I apologize for saying that because I really don't know many people who are really happy about being fat. I hated being fat, and then I stuffed my face because I was fat. I was ashamed of being fat and of my obesity. And who wouldn't be? You know, I had a lot of body odor. I couldn't buy clothes I liked. I had to buy clothes in the fat girl department or in the adults department. My inner thighs chafed until my skin was raw and I couldn't walk. And my jeans wore out in between my legs until they were threadbare. And I just never felt I fit in. Over the years, I went on scores of diets. I went on the no carbohydrate diet, the no protein diet. My favorite, as I'm sure you will appreciate, was the ice cream diet. My mom figured if I stuck to it, I'd have to lose some weight, and milk had protein in it. We weren't very nutritionally evolved back when I was that age. I went on a 500 calorie a day diet, and even though I cheated, I lost weight on that. I lost 50 pounds. And that was the summer before I went to college or university, depending on what continent you're on. And by the time I came home for the first break, 2 months later, I had regained every pound and more. None of my clothes fit. And I just was trying to accept myself right before I came to OA and not gain any more weight. I didn't think it was possible to lose weight and keep it off. So fast forward, after I graduated, I had a French degree. I had spent my junior year in France, my third year of university in France. And after I graduated, I moved back to France, to Paris, which in hindsight, I should have moved maybe to Germany, but I moved to a skinny country because I spoke French and I couldn't buy clothes in my size. I lived in a city of millions of people and they did not have clothes for me that fit me. I was obsessed with my obesity. I was obsessed with food. The first thing I did on payday, I was working illegally. Actually, at that time, I think I was working legally, but the first thing I did was went out and bought a giant sugar dessert thing, huge thing that I would not be able to afford in a few days. And I heard about OA, and on May 14th, 1986, I attended my first OA meeting in the church, in the basement of the American Church in Paris. And I was astounded to find that there actually were people who had lost significant weight and kept it off. Didn't know that was possible. And I was even more amazed that they were not fighting food and they weren't white-knuckling it anymore. So I got abstinent. This is the very fast version, right? I got abstinent. I worked the tools. I lost my abstinence. Funny how that works. And I realized I had to change if I wanted to change. So I asked the scary big book thumper in our meetings to sponsor me. And fast forward 3.5 decades later, here I am with you. I just celebrated my anniversary. On September 6th, I celebrated having 36 years of no snacking, no eating in between meals, no sugar, no alcohol, 36 years of abstinence, and crazy, 36 years of far more often than not neutrality with food. No more fighting cravings for the most part, no more white knuckling it. And I am so grateful. I could talk to you about 30 minutes about my miracle, but that's not what I'm supposed to talk about. So I do want to say that before I get into the topic, for full disclosure, I love the OA and the AA literature equally. But I heard Don said this was a big book meeting, so I went big book on you. I like to say that the big book is the foundation of my house of recovery, and the OA 12 and 12 is the walls of my house of recovery, and my loving higher power is the roof over the walls and the foundation. And the work that I've done in both the books, when actually the OA 12 and 12, the AA 12 and 12, and the AA big book, has allowed me to have a profound alteration in my reaction to life. And that includes my reaction to loving and being loved, and my reaction to not getting my way in every single situation, because I married a saint, but I don't always get my way. So I have to have a profound alteration in not getting my way. And in reacting to eternal questions like, what is the right way to put the toilet paper on the roll? Is it over? Is it under? And why not just do it my way? Okay, so, all right, joking aside, I'm going to turn to the big book. And I will tell you that the big book is full of relationship advice. Sadly, nowhere does it say do it Kimberly's way. I went through the big book, and I actually went through, I set them back there, but I went through my third edition, my fourth edition, and I found close to 100 passages in the book that are totally applicable to me in relationships. Relationships with friends, family, colleagues when I was working, strangers, God, and especially with my husband. The trick in the big book for me when it comes to relationships is to always remember to ask how it applies to me. Not go to Don and say, see this right here? You should be kind and loving. No, I have to say that to Kimberly when he's not listening. I have to apply everything in it to me. Look for the suggestions I can implement. I'm the one that has to change. Bless him, change me. So I tried to get my arms around how to share 100 different things in the big book with you. And I realized that's impossible. So I'm just going to share some of my favorite with you. And I'm going to try and keep an eye on time. I know you'll give me the hook when we need to. I'm very aware that I am one of the lucky ones, that we are one of the lucky couples. my zigs work with his zags. And on my crazy days, Don manages to stay sane. We like to joke, we're not allowed to, we have to take turns in losing it. We have to take turns in being sick. We try to take turns in having bad days and good days. And our zigs and zags work together. When he's feels like Eeyore, I try to be a slightly not too bouncy Tigger. He's, you know, I'm much more Tigger. And there's actually a quote in the Big Book that I found when I was looking for quotes that I had not paid too much attention to, and I would bet a lot of money. None of you could tell me which story in the fourth edition this is in. And I know I got some other Big Book people here. And that is the quote, "The rocks in my head fit the holes in his." And that's in a story called The Perpetual Quest. And I would have not thought I had read the story before, but I had a bunch of stuff underlined, including that quote. And what I like about it is I don't have to find, it tells me, stop looking for somebody who's just like me. It's okay if we're different. It's like if the rocks and the holes in our heads fit together like a puzzle. I picture a puzzle. And if it was all the same piece, if we were both the same piece, we wouldn't fit together. But because we're a different piece, we fit together. So that's my first find in the Big Book today. But there are tons of really more serious examples, and I'm just going to kind of randomly talk about some Big Book quotes that have helped me in relationships. And there's a really good couple of thoughts here that fit with being in relationship with my family, our extended family. Bill tells us, and there is a solution, that we need to develop a real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions. And I am sure I'm not the only one, but there are people in our family who have strong political opinions that are wrong, that are dead wrong. Or maybe I should say that they're not wrong, they're just 100% opposed to my political opinions. Anybody relate? You got family members? We're not going to talk about politics, right? But I have very serious political opinions. They have very serious political opinions. And if you think I'm right, you're good people. So the problem is, that's not a real tolerance of their shortcoming, but of their viewpoint and a respect for their opinions. And I love this because I don't have to agree with them at all. But this quote about having a respect for their opinions and the slogan "live and let live" tell me I can respect their right to have a different opinion, even if I think it's wrong, even if I'm almost morally opposed to it. I can let them have their opinion, and we don't have to talk about it, and we don't have to fight about it. I ask God to help me tolerate their viewpoints and respect their opinions. And if I can't respect their opinions, I ask God to help me respect their right to have different opinions. And then I talk about the weather with them, or whatever. If they were here now, we could talk about London. And then it says, I ask God to show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view, and then parentheses, of those who offend me by having an opinion I don't agree with. I love this. It doesn't tell me I have to be kind and loving to these people. I can ask God for a kind and tolerant view. And I can be tolerant because of the fifth tradition. What's my primary purpose with these close relatives that I love? It's not to win a political argument. My primary purpose with these people is to protect our family connection and take care of my family unit, not be right, not to convert them. Same page 67, we avoid argument. We are never going to agree. So I do what I can do. I own my part to keep us from going there. And they pretty much respond in kind. The book tells me to review my conduct, but not just over the years, but now. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Those are always good questions to ask about me and my relationships with other people. I wish I were evolved and I never was self-centered and I never wanted to win, but I am not. So I have to look at not being selfish, dishonest, and considerate. And the book tells me I have to always be hard on myself. No, be hard on myself and always be considerate of others, and especially my spouse, and especially when I'm in a pissy mood. Again, I hate to tell you I get in pissy moods, but there are some people here from my inner group. They might have seen me once or twice in an off moon. Page 85 tells me every day is a day that I need to carry the vision of God's will into my interaction with my family. I must constantly ask God, how can I best serve thee, God? And how can I best serve thee with my spouse? What's your will, not my will, for my spouse? And then I'll slip in just a little OA. I can act as if. The OA just for today card is awesome in relationships. Especially it talks about doing a good deed and not getting caught. I don't know if anybody loves that just for today card like I do, but what a great thing for relationships. Look for a good deed to do and not get caught. And if I get caught in my good deed, it doesn't count. That's really very helpful for me. And sometimes it helps me if I can't, like, you know, if God wants me to smile when I feel annoyed and say loving things when the best I can do is keep my mouth shut. If I act as if by saying, oh, you know, he would really like it if I did that. And I secretly, when he's not looking, do it and don't say anything and pray rather than wait for him to say, hey, babe, that was awfully sweet. Pray he doesn't notice. That is definitely not Kimberly's will. All right, next, I assume everybody's familiar with page 86 in the book. At night, I ask, now I don't get to be kind and tolerant. Now I have to be kind and loving. Were we kind and loving toward all? Sometimes I have to ask myself, was I at least kind and loving to the person that I love more than anyone else? Sometimes I answer that question well. Sometimes I have to say, well, was I kind and neutral? Was I neutral? Not was I kind of neutral? Was I kind and loving? Was I kind of neutral? Was I thinking of myself or was I thinking of what I could do for my family or my husband? It's an awesome way to check my interactions. It's a great inventory to do. And I love what it tells me to do in the book if I don't like the answer to my question. It tells me to ask God what I could have done better. What could I do better? And God answers me. Sometimes the answer might be, keep your mouth shut, Kimberly. And sometimes my answer to God is, you gotta give me some duct tape, God, because sometimes it's hard to keep my mouth shut. God has nice, gentle, pretty duct tape he puts on my mouth, but I need it sometimes. It might be to pray, bless him, change me. It might be to remember what I'm going to lovingly call for this session, the driving lesson, which is yield, you know, yield, look for the yield sign. So that is at night what it tells me. In the morning, it says, I ask God to direct my thinking. And I'm going to put it, this is really how I say it in the morning. I don't like the word divorce. So in the French big book, where it says divorce my thinking from, it says liberate my thinking from. So I ask God to liberate me from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. And I do that in general, and I can ask God to let me be grateful, honest, and generous with my husband. I like to say, remove this and let me be this. That's part of my sixth and seventh step, right? Take away the defect and let me live in the asset. Let me find, and here's a really great exercise. There are things I'm not grateful for. You know, I'm not grateful that this family member has incorrect political opinions, but I'm grateful they're here and I'm grateful that they love me despite the fact that they think I don't have correct political opinions. So there's always something I can be grateful for. And when my husband's annoying me, I can be grateful that he's here to annoy me. All right, that's kind of cool. I don't take that for granted. I can ask God deliberate, let me have honest motives, or take away self-seeking motives, and maybe I could try to do something Don's way, right? And I'll come back to that a little bit later if I have time. Now, if I did all of that stuff better, I could end my talk now, but I can't, so I've got 7 more minutes or so. So I want to fast forward and talk about some things in the 2 most dangerous chapters of the Big Book. Did you know there are 2 dangerous chapters in the Big Book? I saw somebody shaking their hand. If we had more time, I'd have you write down, guess what the 2 dangerous chapters are, but I'm going to tell you the answer to the question. It's to the wives and the family afterwards. And the reason that these are dangerous chapters, because people read those, and no matter what you tell them to do, they think, my spouse needs to read this. My mother-in-law needs to read this. My so-and-sos with their political opinions need to read this. And that's not, in my mind, that's not the point at all. I can only work my program. I can't work your program. I certainly can't work Don's program. I could never do everything he does. He does so much work. So the point for me and to the wives and the family afterward is to look for things that I can do, even though they're suggesting them to the wife. Same thing with to the employer, but it's not dangerous with the employer because you don't relate to the employer like you do to the wives and the family. We don't. I'm not saying to you, but me. So, and to the wives, remembering that I'm looking for what it says that I can do. Try not to condemn your spouse. Oh, wow. I grew up in a household where that my parents condemned each other. I mean, you know, they told each other what they were doing wrong. When I think Don's doing something the wrong way, I don't necessarily have to tell him. Now, if his life's at risk, maybe I do. Maybe I do need to scream. But most of the time when he's doing something the wrong way, it's like putting the silverware away when it's not drier than Nassau dry, and I could dry it just a little bit better, you know? It says, be careful not to disagree in a resentful or critical spirit. That is such good relationship advice. And I should come back to this one, but I'm going to say it now because I'm taking much longer than I intended to. This is maybe the number one thing in this chapter for all of us to use with our spouses or with our significant others or with our loved ones. And that's when things get heated or edgy or I sound annoyed or they sound annoyed in a conversation, smile and say, this is getting serious. I'm sorry I'm disturbed. Let's talk about this later. And I can tell you, and you could paraphrase it, put it in your version, but like, wow, I'm feeling really on edge right now. And I'm sorry I'm so edgy. Can we take a rain check and come back to this later? Right? That's they won't even know you're quoting Big Book at them. Make live and let live the rule. And there's so much more in here. And the family afterward, focus on what I can give my family, not on what I can take. Let giving rather than getting become my guiding principle. And face the fact that I incredibly am not going to get my way all the time. And I will have to yield to what my husband and my stepkids and my brother and sister-in-law and other people in the family want from time to time. Last 3 things in that chapter are first things first, live and let live, and easy does it. So I really encourage you to go back and read those 2 chapters and force yourself to think about it in that this chapter was written just for me and I can do these things. So there's some various and sundry examples of lessons that I've learned. And I want to talk to you about the rug lesson. This is a great spiritual lesson I learned. And it kind of relates to on page 87. It says, I remind myself I'm no longer running the show. Say many times during the day, thy will, not mine be done. It's also related maybe to the slogan, live and let live. So one day in 2005, 2006, we were in a store that sells a little bit of everything, you know, like the end of stuff that the other stores couldn't sell. And they had some really nice rugs on sale. And they were at a really good price. So we were in there and we're looking at these rugs and we found two we liked. And that's not actually true. We found one I liked and we found one Don liked. So we had one. Do you remember this, Don? Do you know where this is going? So I'm praying. I'm trying so hard. Thy will be done, God. Please let me accept whichever rug we get. Please let him like my rug. How can I say something that sounds spiritual that will get him to like my rug? You know, from the absurd to the ridiculous. And Don, being practical, turns to the salesman who's really happy. And Don says, what do we do here? And the guy says to him, happy wife, happy life. And I thought, well, that's a sexist comment. A happy wife is a happy life. What about the husband? I mean, that's just sexist. That's just wrong. And then I heard my husband saying, okay, then we'll take the one she likes. So I threw my feminist standards out the window and we went home with my rug. And I was thinking about it, our rug, sorry, dear, we still have it later, 20 years later, probably, or 15 years later. And later I was thinking about it and the sexism did bother me and I changed it into a happy spouse is a happy house. So, and I really like that because it's not just the wife that has to be happy or one partner. If it's two wives, it is sometimes we get the rug I like and sometimes we get the rug he likes. Sometimes we take care of each other. Remember to take care of what the other person cares about, to like what the other person likes, take turns. And that leads to the making the bed lesson. So, and this is kind of a funny one, that it's anybody's business, but we make the bed every day. We always have. Don probably doesn't remember this, but you never know what Don's going to remember. So I have to be careful. We used to make it different ways. Now we make it kind of the same way, which is however we can make it, but we make it kind of the same way. No big deal. When we made it different ways, I thought, well, that's fine. You know, he's making the bed. I'm not going to complain. My mom complained about how my dad did stuff and my dad stopped doing them. You know, my mom told my dad enough that he didn't put the stuff in the dishwasher right. So he left it in the sink. So I wasn't making that mistake. I didn't need Bill Wilson's help on that. So okay, he makes a bed, he makes it his way, I make the bed, I make it one day. And one way it hit me, what if I made it his way? Why was I so attached to my way? Maybe I was doing the just for today, I'll do something, a good deed for somebody. Now, I promise you, Don never noticed how I made the bed. I don't think he said, oh, look, she made it my way. I didn't tell him. But it really was a good lesson to me that I can do things I fight things that are inconsequential and I fight things that are consequential. And the point is to stop fighting, let live and let live be the rule. And it says, the more I tried to have my own way, the worse matters get, and I can detach from getting my way. And I don't have time to go a lot farther. There's some great, great things in Acceptance is the Answer on relationships. It's a great place to close. And that is that I can find no serenity until I accept my spouse as being exactly the way he is supposed to be at this moment. When I accept life on life's terms, my husband as he is, I can be happy. when I accept my crazy family members who have mistaken political beliefs the way they are, we can be together in family and focus on our primary principle. And I need to focus my attitude and my mind on what needs to be changed in me and not in other people. And I think I will stop there. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. We will now be transitioning into our question and answer segment. I'd like to introduce Mickey, who is our moderator for today. Over to you, Mickey.
Can't hear you, Mickey.
Hi, I'm Mickey, your moderator for today, and I am a compulsive overeater. And as we transition into the question and answer period, please continue to send your questions in the chat. Just look for moderator Mickey. So we'll try to get through as many questions as we can today. And Kimberly and Don, thank you so much for your talk. I smiled the whole time. And I really, really am grateful for that. So some of these questions are specifically for Kimberly or Don, but I'll ask the ones that, and then you can choose which one of you will answer. The first question I have is, thank you for sharing your 11-step discipline. Would you be willing to share a copy of your sheet with your affirmations and questions for us to use? I think that was for Don. Both of you.
There we go. Sure. Just send me an email. I can't screen share or anything like that. It's lengthy. You couldn't see all the small print. Send me an email, and I believe my email has been posted in the chat.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Don. Secondly, Don, and this one is for you. Don, you talked about your inventory questions. How was it living with me yesterday? Would you share the answer to that with your partner or spouse? And what if they're not in an OA or a 12-step program?
If it was great, good day, then there's nothing to share. I don't think. If it was not such a good day and I owe an amends, that's what these inventories are for. Maybe I need to go back and revisit something that we talked about where I was not quite who I should have been or something like that. So it's the old, if an amends or a change needs to be made, go back and do it, of course.
Okay.
What was the last part of the question? I'm not sure I understood.
It was, what if your partner or spouse was not in OA or a 12-step program?
Oh, it makes no difference. Of course. Makes no difference that she happens to be in OA, but this is all about making amends wherever, whatever the person is, whoever it is, whether you live with them or whether it's the garbage man on the street or whatever that you've harmed. Absolutely.
All right, thank you. And I think this one is probably for both of you, but can you talk about how you might sponsor and or support someone around their relationships if their partner is not in OA or a 12-step program?
Go ahead, Kimberly. I've already talked, and then I'll answer too.
Okay, can you repeat it again, Mickey?
Okay, can you talk about how you might sponsor or support someone around their relationships if, in fact, their partner is not in OA or 12 steps?
So everything I shared is 100% relevant, whether your partner is in OA or not, whether my partner is in OA or not. And I would probably avoid as long as possible the two dangerous chapters. So I might take the questions out of there and give them to my sponsee to write on. But I would have them look at that and look at what principles apply. I mean, to me, there's being in relationship with somebody is all about practicing my recovery on a harder level, because, you know, sometimes the people, they push our buttons because they installed some of the buttons, our family of origin particularly. So it's go through the big book and look for the 100 things I found in the first 164 pages. Oh no, that was included Dr. Alcoholic Addict, but look for the things that apply to relationship and write on them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Can you talk about-
If I can add something on that.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
99% of the people don't have a spouse in the program. So it's a question of are they supported or not? So that's standard. One of my points in my talk was, we can change relationships by changing ourselves. I would like to have a dollar for every time I've heard somebody come back after about the fifth, sixth, seventh step and say, you know, I don't really understand why, but my relationship with my spouse is getting better, right? Now the spouse didn't do a damn thing, but the spouse reacts to changed behavior from the person. So as I fix myself, as I become a better person, people's reactions to me change. And I think, oh, they're changing. What all they're doing is less reacting and better reacting to me. And I have seen this over and over and over and over in all the people that I've sponsored. So you don't have to have a spouse in the program to work the program. As I said, most people do not. Be fortunate. You're very fortunate if you get somebody that supports you. You know, it starts with the food. If you're not going to eat the food that they do, you know, that's the first little point to get through. But after that, just take care of yourself, and the rest often takes care of itself.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, and Kimberly. Can you talk about how you together deal with disagreements or differences of opinion around a major family decision or issue?
Oh.
There's a lot of different answers to that. Sometimes we take turns making decisions. Sometimes to buy this house, we went to a diner and sat down with a sheet of paper and went down the pluses and went down the minuses, and there was the decision. We worked together on major decisions, whatever they may be. We always work together, I think. But Kimberly, what's your take on this?
So, and that doesn't mean we always agree on everything. So that's a great example with the house thing. We had to move for my job. And we looked at houses, and I liked one house a little bit more. He liked one house a little bit more, but we both, you know, they were the top two houses for both of us. And so we really sat down and just wrote down the pluses of each house and the minuses of each house. And when we did that, it was clear that one house had more pluses than the other. I'm trying to think. There have been very few things. I don't know if so. If Don were this, I guess the best example I could give you right now is that I was ready to start traveling a little bit before Don was ready to start traveling as we come out of the pandemic. And there was a point. I think I was thinking about going to see my family with the challenging political positions. And Don asked me not to. And because of COVID and, you know, well, I don't think he asked me not to, but he came and presented volumes of scientific evidence about what was happening with COVID in that geography. And it was clear to me that he really didn't want me to go there, not because of the political stuff that I joke about. And so I guess I have to say, if Don were really opposed to something I wanted to do, I would value that or respect that or honor that is the word I like. I think the same thing. If Don wanted to do something, there was something that we had committed to do, And Don was a little more willing to do it. It happened to be to lead a retreat up in Canada. And I got really scared about what happened. And now I had the COVID stats, but what happened if we got sick or he got sick and we were so far from home and couldn't get back in the States? And I got really scared. And I don't know that I think he agreed with what I was saying. I didn't think he thought it was a risk, but I was so concerned about it that he supported it. So that's easy, right? Because that's the two extremes. And then it's all the stuff in the middle, and it's compromise and yield and take turns. You know, we don't do this literally, but there was a time when we would take turns picking the restaurant we would go to. Now we don't need to do that, because if we go to my favorite restaurants too much, I'll say, oh no, let's go here to your favorite. And Don will do the same with me. But there was a time we just took turns. Like we take turns making the bed.
Yeah. Can I just add one thing to that, Mickey? The bottom line for me on all this stuff is keep talking. Talk, communicate, 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 and do it kindly. Talk kindly and keep talking kindly. And it's a magic how sometimes the solutions just come up. Seems to be the way, God. But you got to keep talking and do it kindly.
Thank you. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Kimberly. This one is about a little different subject. It's about meetings. And there are actually a couple of questions about that. One was from a fellow who said, my OA wife and I rarely cannot go to the same OA meeting. How does this play out for you? And then secondly, someone asked, do you attend meetings together? Do you attend different meetings? And does that get tricky when your partner is annoying you?
Yes, sometimes no. So yes, we attend meetings together. There are some people on the Zoom screen here who've been at meetings with us. It's not tricky, because if there was something going on that I wanted to talk about, I'm not going to talk about it in an OA meeting full of people who know Don, even if he's not there. That's not right. Right? I have to value or respect not as anonymity, but as privacy. Right. So if Don, I can't remember the last time you were so annoying, I needed to vent to somebody other than my sponsor. But first of all, that's why I have a sponsor. We go to meetings together all the time. Don goes to one men's meeting. I've offered to do Zoom hosting in that meeting, but for some reason they never take me up on my offer to be a Zoom host. And I sometimes go to meetings that Don doesn't go to, but he might go the next week. So I really, if there's something I need to talk about and both of us are in program, it has no place in an OA meeting where other people will know who I'm talking about. That's just not right, in my opinion.
Yes, I'll just add one thing. Yes, we go to different meetings and same meetings. It's not an issue. But we both have sponsors, right? 40 years, 38 years, both still have sponsors to talk to. I talk to my sponsor once a week, you know? So that's what sponsors are for.
Thank you both so much. This question is about your step 11 practice. Do you practice it together or apart? And how do you manage your daily prayer and connection to spirit as a couple?
Well, I'll answer first and then let Kimberly go. We don't. She does her 11th step work totally separate from me. And I do mine totally separate from her. It's always been that way. She's in charge of her program in recovery. I'm in charge of mine. As she mentioned earlier, I do a lengthy one. I always take at least 45 minutes in the morning. Crazy, but it's something I need to do now at this stage of my life for a lot of different reasons. I just need to work harder today than I actually had to work 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So I do it by myself and she does it by herself.
Yeah, I would say a gazillion years ago. So remember, we both were in program before we were a couple. So we had separate practices when we started living together and then eventually when we got married. And a gazillion years ago, I generally remember where we lived at the time, but I don't remember where we lived. Probably was when we lived in New York, Don. Mentioned and suggested doing some 11-step work together in the morning. And I couldn't, it distracted me rather than centered me. I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't that I was afraid of what Don would think or anything. It was just so different than my 11th step. And so we just stayed with our own practices. Now, a lot of times we sit in the same room in the morning. We come in and we get our cup of coffee. Our higher powers, both of our higher powers agree that, a good cup of coffee in the morning facilitates staying clear-minded and awake. And so we'll sit in our different chairs and do our readings and prayers and meditation and writing and different time schedules, et cetera. Or if I have a phone call while he's still doing his 11th step, I'll go downstairs so as not to disturb him. So we're separate while we're together in the process.
Okay. Thank you so much, Don and Kimberly. This question came up in a couple of ways, and it's really about having a spouse who's not in program. And the first part of the question is, how do we work on a relationship with a spouse when my husband and or wife is not spiritual, is an atheist, and is not a fellow? And the other has to do with, how do I handle when my spouse or partner brings in food to the house that is not on my program?
So I would say, go into the big book, find every sentence you can and write on it. So love and tolerance is our code. And how would I deal with a spouse who was an atheist, for example? I would, if we had a loving, supportive relationship, I would do my 11th step and I would pray for them and I wouldn't tell them I was praying for them all the time, right? I would do my best to live the principles of this program as laid out in the handout that Don posted and is laid out in the big book. Or if they had very different, some people might be very spiritual and some have a very religious spouse. I have sponsored people who've been very religious and I'm not particularly religious, but I definitely believe in a higher power. Live and let live and pray and bless them and change me. I guess I would take it as God wants me to work on my acceptance. And then with the food, I really don't have any experience, strength, and hope in that in my own home, other than when grandkids visited. And when grandkids visit, typically I buy the junk food for them and I try not to buy the junk food that I like best, the brand that I like best. I buy the cheap stuff because they don't care. I suppose with the spouse, it wouldn't be that easy. But Don?
Thank you.
I'm not in charge of fixing anybody. I'm not in charge of converting anybody to anything or making anybody believe anything. I'm only in charge of taking care of myself. Best thing that I can do is just share my own experience, strength, and hope with people and what I believe, and then it's up to them. That's called do what I can and then let go and let God. So I am not a religious person, by the way. Matter of fact, I usually say I'm a former atheist, but you know, I have a higher power today. But it's the higher power of my understanding. It is not a traditional God at all, in any true sense of the word. But that's the wonder of this program. You know, the book says, deep down inside, we found something. Well, that's what I found, something deep down inside of me, whether I call it higher power, higher self, soul, whatever. The point is, I'm not in charge, and there seems to be something deep inside of me that wants me to be a good person, that wants me to try to live by those things that we put up, that I put up on the screen. That's the best that I can do, is just keep taking care of myself, be an example, try to follow this as best I can. I'm just not in charge of anybody.
Thank you so much, Kimberly and Don. We do have a few minutes left in our Q&A section before we have to end our session. So I wanted to ask these questions related to places and stories you mentioned in the book, because people had asked, one, where can you get the quote about the stone fitting in the holes in the heads in the perpetual quest? And the other was, Kimberly talked about page 118 in the book, in the big book, where it says getting serious. I'm sorry I got disturbed. And people wanted someone to talk a little bit more about that. So if you could just start with the reference of the rocks and the
absolutely. I'm looking for it in my notes here. So that is in, you have to have a fourth edition. So it's not in the third edition. It is on page 397 in the story, The Perpetual Quest.
Okay.
And, thank you. You know, not, if I had to take two or three stories to the grave with me, it wouldn't have been that one. But that was such a great quote. It's worth reading. Because sometimes I don't understand why he has holes in his head, right? But it's because I have rocks, so they fit. And then the other one was, I'm sorry?
Page 118, where it talks about getting, this is getting serious, when you say this is getting serious, I'm sorry, I got disturbed.
Yeah, so that's a great story into to the wives. Very dangerous chapter. So it says, and you and your husband will find that you can dispose of serious problems easier than you can the trivial ones. Isn't that the truth? Next time you and he have a heated discussion, no matter what the subject, it should be the privilege of you, me, to say, this is getting serious. I'm sorry I got disturbed. Let's talk about it later. Since I am trying to live on a spiritual basis, I will be doing everything in my power to avoid disagreement and contention. Now, I know AA wants us to read things the way they're written. So listen to the way it's written and listen to the way I read it. It should be the privilege of either to smile and say, this is getting serious. Sorry, I got disturbed. Let's talk about it later. If your husband is trying to live on a spiritual basis, he will also be doing everything in his power to avoid disagreement or contention. Bad, very bad. That, my friends, is a resentment rating to happen, because my husband hasn't read the book. I've got the book. I need to be doing everything in my power to avoid disagreement and contention.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kimberly. Thank you, Don, for your sharing. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. Kimberly and Don, thank you for sharing your time, your strength, your hope and experience and wisdom with us today. And I will now hand the meeting over to Linda because we've come to the end of our Q&A time.
Thank you, Mickey. A reminder that a design for living, Big Book OA, is a daily meeting. Our meeting days and times are based out of Melbourne, Australia. 6:30 a.m. start from Monday to Friday and 7:30 a.m. start on Saturday and Sunday. Our next meeting is tomorrow, 1 hour earlier than you logged in today. Please check out our website for more information on the time zones at www.ad4l.info. In closing, I would like to thank Kimberly and Don and all of you for your service in coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honour each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together we get better. To close the meeting, will Robin please unmute and read the promises which will be on the screen. Thank you, Robin, just in time.
Thanks. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Thank you.